But we're very happy that Michael Grazer could come up, down.
Down, up,
Santa
yeah.
Cruz today, and tell us about, I guess, brain rolls.
That's right. So that's the title. Oh, there we go. That's the title of my talk. And if you're here to hear, if you want to hear about Planet World Suzy Breaking, then just go next door, I guess. And so this is work done with Alexei Anisimov, who's a student of Michael's, and then Michael Dine, and also Scott Thomas. So I'll provide a brief. I'll just give you my outline. So I'll give you some motivation and sort of the context for Brain World Suzy Breaking, and sort of the issues we'll be interested in are actually contact interactions that are volume suppressed between fields on different brains in the low energy theory. So I'm going to be talking about that, and actually we'll provide some examples of this from Hrabar-Witten theory and open strings, and then also D-brains. And today I don't think I'll get to talk about Hrabar-Witten and Calabi-Yau. And then also I'll have sort of some neutral comments about a situation with just one extra dimension. Okay, so people have been studying brain worlds now for a number of years, and there are many interesting reasons for doing that. Localized gauge matter, which is a rather novel property, can also physically isolate sectors from one another, except through gravitational interactions. There are also fundamental objects in string theory. And also very interesting, they also provide an entropy counting for black holes, and also you can get some sort of novel early cosmology, which we've seen recently on the archives. And also they've been very important in phenomenology, as we've often seen. They've led to some new ideas for maybe solving the hierarchy problem for large extra dimensions, warping. Also led to some new ideas for solving the flavor problem and also supersymmetry breaking, which will be the subject of this talk. So when you're talking about supersymmetry breaking, you sort of have in mind a sort of paradigm which is sort of appropriate for most models of Suzy breaking, I wouldn't say for all models of Suzy breaking, and that is we have some visible world, we're over here, and then supersymmetry breaking occurs in some hidden sector. And you can see I put some other people over there in the hidden sector. Yeah. And then there's also some other. Right, yeah, that would be better. And then there's something that mediates the supersymmetry breaking. And that's sort of, if you look at a lot of models of supersymmetry breaking, this is the structure. People have written down models where actually the mediators or the standard model fields themselves, but that's sort of actually rare. These so-called composite models by Akani, Hamad, Ludi, and can't remember the third person, but sorry. Okay, so when we talk about supersymmetry breaking, there are sort of some issues that we're interested in, both from a low energy and a high energy perspective. And that is, from low energy, there's sort of a number of issues that you'd like to learn about. One of them is, well, just what is the spectrum? You have heavy particles, light particles, are they heavy enough to evade all the collider signatures? Also, you want to make sure that you get the right pattern of gauge symmetry breaking. We don't want color, for example, to be broken or charge to be broken. And also, actually very important for supersymmetry phenomenology is there are very stringent constraints on the pattern of Suzy breaking from flavor-changing neutral currents. For example, the non-observation of mu d gamma or the KK-bar mixing and the mass difference between the two kaon mass eigenstates. And typically, these constraints are very strong. So 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 2, and you have to, you know, keep in mind that these are in the off-diagonal squark mass matrices. And keep in mind I'll have similar constraints for the slepton sector and the squark sector, and there are a large number of squarks. So these are, you know, there are a lot of small numbers here that people would like to explain. Now from the high energy, we'd like to understand where does supersymmetry breaking come from, and also maybe has been sort of advocated by Michael Dine over the past year, and that is, can maybe string theory make a prediction that you always have low energy supersymmetry, and that maybe for some reason the non-supersymmetric string models are inconsistent for whatever reason. So that would be great if somebody could do that. And also, if you have a given model of Suzy breaking, you would like to know, are there any generic features, predictions that you can make within that model? And then also, are there maybe any other things which are maybe more specific to that particular model? And of course, we'd like to relate the two. So now that we have these different sectors, And actually, for a lot of low-energy SUSY phenomenology, you can just concentrate on what are basically the objects that are transmitting supersymmetry breaking. So these would be some messengers that have interactions with the standard model fields. And typically, the details of supersymmetry breaking, you don't need to know about this. And so, of course, these are important questions, but it's mainly, at least for low-energy phenomenology, it's the interactions with the messengers with the standard model fields that are interesting. And so now when I'm coming to think about brain models of supersymmetry breaking, I'm going to have in mind that supersymmetry breaking is on a hidden brain. And this can actually, so the supersymmetry breaking, as I say here, can occur in two places. One is either in the fields that are on the hidden brain, or it can also occur in the moduli. So I just wanted to make that point. But again, I'm just going to, if you like, just sort of input the SUSY breaking and not worry about where that comes from. And so there have been ideas for breaking supersymmetry in a hidden brain. And so generically, as I've said, I'm going to imagine that, at least for now, that SUSY breaking just occurs on one of these distant brains. And for the moment, let me just assume that none of the moduli have supersymmetry breaking. And also, now again, people have, there are many different options, but I'm going to just sort of simplify the discussion. And first of all, assume that none of the standard model fields propagate in the bulk. Okay, so that's, people have relaxed that assumption and thought about SUSY breaking in that context, but I'm going to do the simplest thing and assume that, for example, there aren't any gauge matter in the bulk that could couple the stuff on the distant brain. And I'm also going to assume, and it's sort of reasonable if you think about locality in the higher dimensional theory, that there's no direct coupling between fields on the different brains in the higher dimensional theory. So now if I go ahead, there's sort of an intuition that if I go and look at the four-dimensional effective theory, well, so I look at scales below the mass, the scale associated with this geometry, and the sort of intuition that the standard model field is only coupled to supergravity, but there's no direct tree-level couplings to the hidden sector. Okay, so this will actually be important, and I'll come back to this. But it's sort of a known fact in supergravity that that the F component, so in the four-dimensional supergravity multiplet, there's this thing called the conformal compensator that can acquire, or the supergravity multiplet can acquire an F component. And it's known that the F component of that compensator does not lead to tree-level Gugino masses or scalar masses. Okay, so the intuition then is that since in the low-energy theory, the fields on our brain only couple to supergravity in the bulk, then at tree level there are no soft supersymmetry breaking masses for both the scalars or for the Gugino's. Okay, so they're massless at tree level. And just more, you can put this a little bit more concretely in terms of a statement about the Kähler potential in the low energy effective theory. And that is in 4D supergravity, there's a special frame that's called the conformal frame, where there's there are supergravity techniques that look very similar to global supersymmetry. And so basically the only difference, at least formally, is that you've now introduced some field which can have an F component that would then be on the order of the Gravitino mass. And the rule is that this conformal compensator just appears everywhere there's a mass term, either in your Kähler potential or in your superpotential. So you can now see, if I think of this higher dimensional example where I have fields on one brain and just the fields in our brain, then it's reasonable that in the low energy theory that maybe there's some separability of the fields on the fields in our brain and then the fields on the other brain. Okay. And so you can see then that, well, if you look up here, if I imagine, I didn't write this down, sorry, but if you just have Q dagger Q and sigma dagger sigma and explicitly no couplings between the two sectors, then the only place I could get SUSY breaking for the soft mass is either from F component of the hidden field or from the conformal compensator. But the conformal compensator doesn't couple to Q dagger Q. So at tree level, there are, yeah.
Language.
Yeah.
And you're using it in a higher dimensional supergravity, but I don't think it even exists.
Well, this is just in the four-dimensional effective theory.
Four-dimensional.
Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right. In the higher dimensional theory, I can't do that.
Transmission requires something in the higher dimension. You can summarize that in the effective
I mean, I'm going to come back to the talking about transmission of supersymmetry breaking, and you'll see that the arguments I presented here are too simple. Okay, and then more specifically, so to connect with what people, when we usually do conventional supergravity in four dimensions, it's convenient to just calculate what's called the Einstein frame, where there's no field dependence in front of the curvature tensor. And that's related to this thing I've called F, so the Kähler potential, through the special relation. So the separability of this particular, these kinetic terms, is a statement about the Kähler potential that must be of this specific form. In particular, the 3 is important here. Okay. So given that there are no tree-level masses, you may wonder, well, what's the leading effect? There is some supersymmetry breaking. It's going to be transmitted somehow. So what is it? Well, Rando and Sundrum sort of, they thought about this. And we can think about SUSY breaking from two possible sources. One is just from bulk effects. And so you might think that, well, if I have any massive states in the bulk, then that they're exponentially suppressed. So that can be tiny. Also, suppose I have a field in the bulk that has a linear coupling. So this is a massless field in the bulk, which has a linear coupling in the Kähler potential. So these are then the fields, say, on our brain. This is on the hidden brain. They can exchange B. But if you just look at this and look at the action, so we want, in order to generate a direct coupling between the fields on the hidden brain and the fields on our brain, we need a direct coupling of this form. But if you look at this in component form, you'll see that, well, for example, there's F dagger FB, but then B couples to derivatives of L. So when I integrate out B, I don't get a correction to the Kähler potential. You can also ask about loop effects. So tree level doesn't seem to be anything. But there is something at the loop level they spoke about. And so, for example, I could have B dagger B, L dagger L. You can draw down a diagram like this. And interesting, this is ultraviolet finite because you've actually separated the brains. And then there's actually, if you just do the R counting, I won't go through the details, but basically just take derivatives of this propagator, you find that there is something that's order m3 half squared, but then it's volume suppressed. Okay, so this can be very tiny if R is big enough, but my next point will be is that this will be smaller compared to the next possible sources of generating supersymmetry breaking masses, and that would just be from low energy effects in the four-dimensional effective theory. And this is what's called anomaly mediation that was proposed by these people. So the idea is that, well, we know that the conformal compensator is non-zero, so let me now look at loops in the low energy theory involving the supergravity, but actually in particular, if you think about loops, well, I have to regulate the theory. And so it involves the introduction of a Pauli-Villars regulator, which I'll just write like this. So it has some mass term, but the point is that the conformal compensator couples to operators that have mass dimension. So this results in a B-term mass for the Pauli-Villars regulators. So now I can now stick the Pauli-Villars regulators in a loop, just at one loop, and this will actually generate a Gugino mass at one loop. And it's non-decoupling, because this is just like gauge mediation, but where the Pauli-Villars regulators actually are the mediators. And you can see that the F component over the mass is m3 halves. And the contribution is, in the one loop contribution, it scales this way, and so this doesn't decouple as I make the mass very large. And this is why it's called an anomaly. And another interesting thing is that this only depends on the number of, basically on your low energy spectrum. And you can sort of see that because now if I imagine giving a mass to one of the light flavors, then it's also going to generate a B-term and then also give a mass. And that mass can cancel the contribution from the Pauli-Villars regulator. And so you're just left with the number of light flavors.
But yeah. No R.
Oh, what's R? The representation? R. That's buried in m3 halves. Yeah. This is the gravitino mass. I didn't write this down, but this has some dependence on 1 over r. So as you make the brains very big, the gravitino mass goes as superpotential squared divided by the Planck mass squared. Yeah, so actually, this is sort of the So that's actually an important effect, because the things that we'll be talking about later are volume suppressed. We have to keep in mind that the gravitino mass is also volume suppressed, so they can be competing effects. So there's a more general expression, and that is, so the gravitino, this is very nice. I mean, so this anomaly mediation can make very definitive predictions for what the low energy spectrum is. And the reason it can make definitive predictions is because this just depends on the coupling constants and whatever's in your light energy, in your low energy theory. And I've written down what those predictions are, so it depends on the beta function and the low energy gauge couplings. And several nice features of these predictions is that, for example, the soft scalar mass is on the order of the gaugino mass. And phenomenologically, this is very good, because if the gauginos are very light, then in order to avoid experimental constraints, the scalars have to be very heavy. And then just for sort of as a figure of merit, the typical size is actually alpha over 4 pi times m3 halves. So it's 10 to the minus 4 times the gravitino mass. So another very important prediction of these theories is that it solves the flavor problem. The squarks and the sleptons are diagonal in the same basis that the leptons are diagonal. And another thing I should emphasize is that actually this is so predictive, it's actually excluded. And that's just because the beta functions here for the SU2 and the U1 and the MNSSM is negative. Okay, now I'm going to put on a slide that could get me into trouble, because I don't know that much about these papers that I'm going to quote. But some people have actually looked at anomaly mediation just within purely four-dimensional supergravity and have found that in order to actually recover those predictions, there's some additional assumptions. As I said, I don't really understand these papers, but I thought I should, you know, let you know that people have found that there are these extra assumptions. And so in particular, the first authors point out that actually you can think of these formulas that, in particular, they actually just look at the gaugino mass as being fixed by the three U1s in the low energy supergravity theory. There's a U1 from the R symmetry, there's a Kähler U1, and then just the normal chiral rotations. So those have some anomalies, and the claim is you can lift this to superspace, and then and that's going to depend on the conformal compensator, and then when you put in some Suzy breaking in the general superspace expression for those anomalies, then you do recover the previous gaugino mass anomaly mediated results, but only with additional assumptions. In particular, if the VEV the fields in the hidden sector are much less than the Planck scale. And the other thing is that they point out, for example, if this is coming from string theory, and if your T-duality is exact, which it is in string theory, then whenever you do T-duality, of course, that's giving you a Kähler transformation on your low-energy Kähler potential. And that induces a U1 transformation on your fermions, which is anomalous. So the only way you can cancel the anomaly if there are additional local operators in your theory that would then cancel that. But then an F component, so this is an example that they write down, but then an F component for T can then give you a mass for the gaugino that depends on, you know, FT, and that's model dependent. And then Galliard and her student pointed out that actually even what I said about the Pauli-Villars regulators was maybe too naive, and that is, for example, if they have soft masses, if the Pauli-Villars regulators have tree-level soft masses, then that can change some of those previous predictions, and also some additional assumptions on the hidden sector potential.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, so that's okay. I won't be talking about those models, but that's right. So you can put the gauginos in the bulk. That's right. So, and in that case, in that model, you imagine that you put the gauginos in the bulk, and then you imagine that there's an operator on the hidden brain, just some singlet. So this is the field that breaks supersymmetry. This can then give you a tree level gaugino mass, and then the contributions from that contribution I believe, is the Gugino mass contribution from this case is on the order of m3 halves, and I believe divided by maybe root times ml, but I have to compare that to the alpha over 4 pi times times the Gravitino mass. So this can be larger, but then what's also important is that now that I have this contribution, the Gravitino mass, then actually I can just look at loops of the Gravitinos now, just loops of the Gravitinos in the low energy theory can give me a contribution to the soft mass that's of this order. And then this will be larger than the anomaly mediated contribution. Yeah, so this can avoid the tachyon problem. Yeah.
Which are they?
So all of them. Yeah. Yeah, you put everything in the bulk. Yeah.
Don't you lose that property soon?
Gauge unification.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. If you want to maintain gauge coupling unification, then they can't be. Yeah. Yeah, there are three versions of Randall syndrome. Actually, I wrote this wrong. It's actually, I mean, it makes sense it's volume suppressed because this is just coming from the wave function renormalization of the Gugino. Okay, so what we would like to do is actually sort of take a step back and then think about what happens just again at tree level in some of these brain models. In particular, I said the figure of merit you want to compare it to, it's alpha over 4 pi times m3 halves, which is very tiny. And so you might ask, why is that the leading contribution? Can there be other leading contributions at tree level that are order m3 halves? So we're going to look at some examples. I'll begin with just the Hrabal-Witten theory. And so this is very similar to this idea of having, we literally have separated brains. And in the bulk, we just have the graviton and then just four-dimensional field strength. And these Kähler potential corrections to the Kähler potential have actually been calculated by these authors. And the sort of issues that we'll be interested in, actually, is it true that fields on different brains decouple? Now, of course, they are going to decouple as, you know, some part of the volume, but that's sort of the issue. How quickly do they decouple? And we'll see that there are a number of issues, so a number of features. One is that when you have codimension one, you typically have growth of bulk fields. And we will see, so I will also refer to this as, quote, volume suppressed, though it's not. But in general, there will be volume suppressed contact interactions. And these generically will lead to tree level order m3 half squared masses. Okay, so what we'll actually consider are n equals 4 compactifications of Hrabal-Witten. So, of course, those in Calabial have been considered by Witten and Lucas Overt and Waldrum. But we're mainly interested in sort of generic, to what extent are these issues that I was referring to robust? And so, even though this phenomenologically may not be realistic, it's still fine to investigate what sort of corrections you might expect in a more realistic theory. So, for example, so I'm going to consider compactifications on Torii, this preserves n equals 4. And just to remind you of what the low energy particle content is, well, we have some size moduli, and then we have just the size of the extra dimension. We have some adjoint matter now on the different brains, which are sometimes called phi or A, primes will be stuff on the other brain, and unprime will be on our brain. And just also to point out, there'll be a number of U1s, so we have this three-form potential. And these are actually massive, but they'll actually be important, and I'll come back to this. And the reason there's no massless mode is because this is Z2 odd under the Z2 symmetry.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are the off-diagonal ones that you're worried about, the geometric.
Yeah,
yeah, we can include those. Okay, so we're interested in the Kähler potential, and we can actually obtain the Kähler potential by noting that, so here we have strong string coupling on the heterotic side, by noting that it's going to be the same as the Kähler potential at weak string coupling. And you can think of that in one of two ways. One is that we have n equals 4 supersymmetry, and so that's going to protect the Kähler potential. The other thing I can imagine doing is just imagine a limit where the size of these tori is bigger than R11, but of course still bigger than the string scale. And then when I do a dimensional reduction, I'll go from 11 to 10 to 4. And then the 10-dimensional Lagrangian is basically unique as far as the field content goes and the structure of the interactions. And so people have computed what the Kähler potential is in those cases at weak coupling. And it actually, there's a more generic expression that I'm going to show in the next slide. But if you just look at the contribution to the from the diagonal moduli, then it has this form, which is, of course, has a logarithm. And I'm actually going to explain where this comes from in a few slides. But I just want to get to the phenomenology first. And so why don't I just go to the next slide? And actually, if you just look in Joe's book, there's a more general expression. So this actually includes those other moduli that you were referring to. And so the point is that this doesn't have the special form that I was referring to earlier. Okay, the special form before was minus 3 log and then blob in the middle, whereas this is a sum of logarithms. And so what this means is that if I give an F component to one of these fields, say the hidden sector field, but I assume that, you know, the dilaton and the moduli have zero F components, then I do get tree level masses from the squarks for the fields in our brain. In particular, those are the order M3 halves squared and not universal. And I should point out that we can do a projection in which the previous Kähler potential that I had before does reduce to the sequestered form if I do some additional assumptions. So I had the compactification on these three tori. So imagine that there's a Z3 symmetry on these tori. So in total, I have a Z3 cube symmetry on the tori. And this is a symmetry of the low energy theory. And so I'm going to look at states that are invariant under a combination of three Z3s. Okay, So this is sort of standard from orbital folds. So I can just pick for, so these are the, this is the SU3 generator, if you like, and then these are just the complex tori. So I can choose states to be invariant under this Z3 times that one. That'll be one Z3, but then I'm going to choose also another Z3. So that's a 1 minus 1. So I'll choose states to be invariant under that Z3 as well. So let me just look at the states that are invariant under all of the Z3 cubed. So I've written it here. Well, at least let me just focus on the matter. Okay. So these are the adjoint matter. And it's just going to pick out states for which the torus index is the same as the index in the SU3. And these are non-SU3. These are not SU3, full SU3 multiplets. Okay. And this just transforms as a 27, a V6. Now, so what I'm doing something a little funny here, because people don't know how to construct orbital folds on Harava-Witten theory. But I'm just going to proceed and assume that, you know, maybe in the future people know how to do this. And I'll just say that, you know, if you could do something like this, you know, we don't even know what the consistency conditions are for such an orbital fold. There aren't even any strings. But let me just say what the, just sort of go ahead with this. And so if you just look at the previous Kähler potential for those sets of the states that are invariant under that the Z3 cubed, then it is just the sum of the logarithms. So this kills the off-diagonal ones. And now let me make a further assumption, and I assume that there's a symmetric, there's a permutation symmetry that's actually preserved by the vacuum. So if I assume that all the tori have the same size, and then all the F components have the same value, and then I also just focus on the one state in my, on my brain that is invariant under the permutation symmetry. If you do all that, then the Kähler potential does have this sequestered form. That could be, but again, yeah, I don't have a good motivation for this. I'm just sort of giving an example of what you might have to do. No, I'm just projecting out states that aren't invariant under the symmetry and just focusing on this.
And the, you get this inherited Kähler potential?
If you also assume that the fluctuations maintain the symmetry.
Yeah. Well.
So there would be additional contributions for the
The three comes from saying all the same.
Yeah, that's right.
So in general, it would be, you have a separate contribution for each of these three, and setting the people that are.
I guess the question is what's been going to
Okay, repeat the question there. So.
Well, are these asymmetric fluctuations that would change the form of the Kähler potential going to affect the.
Oh, I see. Right. So. Well, see, I've got myself in a bit of a bind here because I'd like to do this. If I didn't do this projection, then we would have had n equals 4 supersymmetry. And then I would have said that. Let me back up. See, if I just focus on the states that are invariant under these symmetries, so I'm not doing a projection, then I wouldn't expect there to be any corrections to the Kähler potential. But, I mean, this is something we're a little confused about. And so we're a little bit confused on whether or not you really need to do an orbital fold to really throw out those states in order to preserve the sequestered sector, or whether I can just focus on some states that are invariant and not throw out the other ones. If I can do the second case, then I'm still preserving n equals 4, and then I wouldn't expect there to be any corrections. But so in
this set of states fall into n equals 4.
I agree, right? So if we really did the projection, then this will be n equals 1, and and then we would have to worry about whether this Kähler potential is protected. And I agree with that, and I think that's what you were asking about, even.
You're worried about three-level contributions involving asymmetric fluctuations.
Oh, so no, I'm assuming that the F component is, so just again at tree level, I'm just assuming the F component is, it has an S3 symmetric. So I don't think there are any. Oh, you're asking if the asymmetric states get mass at tree level. That's true.
Yeah. TI have the same delta. Yeah. You could still a priori have different fluctuations plus delta TI. Right.
Oh, yeah.
That's all.
Oh, yeah, so the states which aren't invariant under this permutation symmetry and also under the Z3s, they'll get mass at tree level.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. That's. Can you remind us why they
I don't have a good intuition for that, actually.
But it was important for their predictions.
Yeah, no, of course it is. And so, I mean, this is sort of what led us on to that, is because we didn't understand basically their argument. I mean, I basically gave you, I think, what the argument was, although it would be better if Lisa were here and then she could tell me why I was
based
wrong.
Based on this n equals 1 language, mm-hmm. function separates into function of fields on one grain plus fields on the other grain, which relies on n equals one grain, which was apparently too naive to take into account the system of network.
Yeah, so. So definitely, that yeah, there's this assumption about the separability of this f function. So certainly, if it has that separability, then you do have this prediction. But why you have that, what the intuition goes into having that separability, isn't clear to us when you in general have extra super. Yeah, I think so. I think, yeah, I didn't want to quite say that, but yeah.
There still is locality in the extra dimension, but you don't need separability.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to show that next. Okay, so what went wrong with the intuition that fields living on different brains don't couple? And so the point is that we have, in particular, we have this three-form field potential in the bulk. And as Horava-Witten found, it actually couples to sources on the brain. There's a modified Bianchi identity for those fields. And in particular, involves the Chern-Simons form. And so that means that I can generate a profile for the field in the bulk. Either a classical profile, if, for example, I did a Calabi-Yau compactification, which would give me some classical expectation value to J. Or if I'm, in this case, since I'm compactifying on tori, so there's no classical expectation value for these currents, but if I want to integrate out stuff in the bulk, I have to see how they depend on the low energy fluctuations. And so that means that when I consider a low energy fluctuation of my fields in the boundary, which, so the matter fields actually come from these bulk gauge fields, and that's going to, the fields in the bulk are going to depend on the fluctuations on the brain. And you can go ahead and solve that Bianchi identity. And so you find, and actually just want you to focus on the Chern-Simons term. So you find that the field strength, at least with these particular components, depends on the Chern-Simons field on the boundary. So if I'm constructing an effective action, well, there's a G squared in the bulk, so I integrate that out, then I'm going to get a Chern-Simons squared coupling. The Chern-Simons term involves the gauge field on one wall, the gauge field in the other wall, so I get couplings between the different brains just from the square of this. I get some cross term. And actually, I'm going to show that this is actually precisely these couplings that lead to the tree level masses.
So does this depend on the distribution of
five frames?
Oh. If you have symmetric embedding, you would be exactly zero, yes.
Okay, I don't know the answer to that. I'm just doing the simplest thing where I just have, I'm not sticking any other brains in the interval. I'm just right. Having these two boundaries.
For me, like, I'm saying the last time you broke
it. Yeah. That's right.
So G is defined in the bulk?
Yeah, G is a bulk field.
So when G is located, evaluated above, the second
term defined
in the bulk?
So G, no. No, this is evaluated in the bulk. It's constant in the bulk. The reason is that I'm turning on some fields on one brain, and that's just going to set up a profile of the bulk field. No, so these are sources that are on the brain, but I'm just then turning on the sources. So you're right, these are fields that are localized on the brain, but then when I turn on the sources,
that... Is there a delta function in second field?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're asking me if there's a delta function here?
Yeah.
No, there's no delta function.
Well, I don't understand the equation. What is it? Mm-hmm. Zero? Only like zero in the last.
How does the last term depend on the whatever the
It's constant.
Oh, it's constant.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't depend on. Yeah, so it involves the gauge fields, which are localized on the boundary, but there's no delta functions. Let me see if I can.
So I integrate
it. Yeah, I can write down the solution if you want. I can look it up in my notes. Let's see. Oh yeah. So. Well, this is what I'm doing at the this is what I'm doing at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Which, it's true that, so I'll be looking at, when I do this integration of the bulk, I'm looking at scales less than the distance between the brains. So that, yeah, that's where that contact interaction comes from. No, so this contact, yeah, so this contact interaction I'm referring to here between the fields on the different brains, this is in the low energy theory. Okay, so there's just some algebra here then to show you that those Chern-Simons terms in the low energy theory then lead to that Kähler potential that I said before. And so, for example, you can look at the kinetic terms for the matter fields, and those depend on the metric, and that, so the tori, and that, and they go as 1 over r squared in the Einstein frame. You also have some kinetic terms for the radii, but then in particular, there's the Chern-Simons squared term, when you work it out in terms of the matter fields, has just this following structure, and a 1 over r to the fourth. And then as, well, this goes back to what Witten did in 85, but I can actually now write this in a supersymmetric way. Sorry, in n equals 1 language, if I do the following field redefinition for t. And then you find that this following Kähler potential with this field redefinition then generates all three of those. Okay. You can also, so this is sort of a response to the question that we saw that the soft scalar masses were non-universal. In particular, there was one that was tachyonic at tree level, and then there was one that, there were two actually that weren't this, that weren't tachyonic. And so there's some, the soft masses are not universal, okay? So you'd like to understand where that flavor violation comes from. And actually, we can understand that if I then just look at the, or I just basically just doing a dimensional reduction, and actually this, if you look at the three-form field strength, actually in five-dimensional language, I can interpret that in terms of gauge boson. So it's a 5D gauge boson. And in particular, the Bianchi identity that I wrote down before in terms of the four-form field strength, in terms of these fields, it contains, there are other contributions as well, but I just want to focus on this bulk U1. There's a modified Bianchi identity for the U1, okay? And in particular, I'll have different U1s depending on which, if you like, tori label I have. And so there's these different U1s couple to currents differently on the boundary. The Bianchi identity, if you like, is different for the different U1s. And so this is a possible interpretation of, well, not a possible, I think this is the interpretation of the origin of the flavor violation. Okay, so now I'd like to ask, so not think about Hrabar-Witten now, but think about open strings and whether we can also see if there are any Chern-Simons squared terms that are suppressed by the volume that appear in the low energy theory. And we will find them, you know, so to give you an example, and that is, so let me take type 1, which is 32 brains, and just compactify in a circle. And the type 1 theory has, so it has a two-form bulk potential, and the 10-dimensional Lagrangian has this following form, and so when I reduce it to just by on a circle, I get an R here. And also, if I just focus on the components that are perpendicular to the brain, then I'll have so Chern-Simons squared term. But now let me think about doing a t-duality. We know the low energy theory is invariant under t-duality. So if I do t-duality on this Lagrangian, then I have, so r goes to 1 over r prime, and then I have the following fields, but you can see that there's a Chern-Simons squared term divided by the volume, okay, that would show up. And now in the brain picture. And we can see from the brain picture that these two, you can understand the origin of those two terms from the brain picture. The first one is easy, because the two form, when you do the t-duality, is a three form. And then if you just look at it, it's the kinetic term for the three form. Then, so there's a volume factor, but then there's a metric factor. So that gives me the 1 over r prime. And then the coupling of the three-form to the Chern to the Chern-Simon form comes from the Wassermino couplings, and so I'm integrating over 9 brains. So I need things that I need 2 gauge fields, and then I need something to add up to 9. So I have an F wedge F and a 5 form. So I can write that, that's d omega, so I can write that as the Chern-Simons term, and then it's wedge d5, and then I can use a Poincaré duality to write the d5 as four-form field strength. But in doing that, there's some dependence on the metric, so you have to use the epsilon tensor. And this gives you a 1 over r prime, which is precisely the same r dependence as the what I saw on the other side from doing the t-duality. So from t-duality, so it seems like, again, if you now just from the brain picture, so it looks like when you look at the low, so I have a brain and then I have some transverse volume, and I look at energies below the scale associated to the volume of the space transverse to the brain, then it looks like that there's a Chern-Simon squared interaction. And we're thinking about where this actually might come from in the brain picture, and we suspect it might be due to winding modes. And well, Michael has a student looking at this. And now I'm going to show that this actually leads to, also in this picture, to order M3 halves, to tree level masses as well. Okay. So again, I'll consider just 7 brains. So, and I'm going to wrap them on, so I'll compactify down to 4 dimensions, and they'll be on 2 of the tori, and then 1 of them will be free. And so from we expect then, or at least from t-duality, we see that there'll be a Chern-Simon squared interaction divided by the R1 squared for the other torus. Yeah, sorry. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I agree generically there will be sources. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I guess all I want to say there will be some special choices, mm-hmm. for example, where the D-brains are on top of the Orient poles.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, are there some special cases where the original
neural system is? Oh, so you're wondering maybe, for example, this coefficient could be 0?
Yeah.
Okay, that's true. I don't know the answer. That could be true. I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, I can really see what you're saying. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, I think if we understood, if we were able to understand this, where this came from in the theory, then we'd be able to see whether in what circumstances that's 0. Okay, that's good. So again, if we this is just some algebra, but you might have thought that, well, I have this Chern-Simon squared coupling suppressed by volume. Is this going to give me, in the low energy theory, a soft mass that's M3 halves squared suppressed by a volume? Okay, and the answer to that will be no. And it comes about through some, I guess, there's some Weyl rescaling. So if I look at the 4D theory, then so, for example, this is just the kinetic term. This comes from the metric. This is, say, the gauge field that corresponds to 1 of the tori. It's 1 over R2 squared. This is just from the volume and then the dilaton. But then the Chern-Simon squared term, so it has this 1 over R1 squared, which is just that volume. And then since I need 2 inverse metrics, there's that power. But now the point is that when I do the Weyl rescaling to Einstein frame, basically I want to get rid of that. Then the kinetic term, the coefficient of the kinetic term is basically, of the terms involving 4 fields is the square of the term involving 2 fields. Okay, and it was having this, once I have this property, I can then write that in a nice supersymmetric way. And so you just have some set of field redefinitions as before for these, for the geometric variables, and then you can write the Kähler potential in this following form, which is not sequestered. Okay. But now there's an extra point here. So I haven't actually separated the brains here at this point. Okay. So I want to actually separate, you can see that written. I want to separate the brains and then put Suzy braking on the other brain. And so we expect. And again, we're just relying on n equals 4 supersymmetry here, that when you, if you can go along a direction where you give expectation values to these fields, that this Kähler potential will be corrected. Okay. And then the hidden sector field, now the fields in the other brain connect to Suzy braking. And then if I can, then I can use that Kähler potential and find that there are order n 3 halves squared corrections. Okay. Any questions so far? Because I'm going to. Let's see. How much time do I have? 10 minutes, 20 minutes? Keep going. Okay. All right. Okay. So you can also have. So here we actually won't be able to say definitively whether or not there are order n 3 halves squared corrections, tree level corrections, in this example. But again, the D brain connector sources for the dilaton and the graviton. And so this is well known. And we're just following an analysis due to Brode and just sort of adding a little bit to it. And that is the metric at the location of the brain it's not just flat, but there's some dependence or some warping. Okay. And so you can go ahead and look at the D brain action and look at the dependence on this warp factor. Okay. So here are the fields, which when I compactify will then give me some matter. And you see that, so there's some prefactor, and then, so there's a general bunch of factors that may or may not give me a correction. And if I pick the P brain to be the same as, the dimension of the P brain to be the same as the probe brain, and assume they're parallel, so this preserves n equals 4. And so you might expect that there should be no correction to the kinetic term. And actually, you can see that when you stick in that for these values, that there's no correction to the kinetic term. So it maybe is sort of some evidence that in the previous example, when we separate the brains in the n equals 4 example, that there are no corrections to the Kähler potential. But for example, we can consider a case that just preserves n equals 2. And in this case, there is a correction to the kinetic terms of the fields in the brain that depend on the moduli. So just a comment about that. So this is more of a phenomenological comment. One is that this coefficient could just be tiny. So it depends on sort of there's some model dependence to that. The other point is that if the modulus acquires an F component, then it sort of is most likely that this will then lead to a tree level mass. I mean, we haven't determined the Kähler potential in this case, but it seems reasonable since there's a direct coupling between the modulus and the brain fields that this would lead to a tree level mass. Of course, may or may not be big or small. If R is big enough, then it can be suppressed. And the other thing I should point out is that we haven't really established whether the sequestered form is violated here, because I've only looked at corrections to the kinetic terms for fields, whereas to really match onto the four-dimensional effective theory, you need to basically compute these sorts of operators. And we haven't done that, and you would have to integrate out the bulk fields in the presence of this correction to the background metric. One possibility is this, and then plus whatever else that you had. But I don't want to say anything. So since we didn't compute the Kähler potential, I really can't say here. Okay, so I would just like to spend the last little bit on sort of one scenario in which we have sort of just mainly some neutral comments. And that is in the case where you just have pure five-dimensional supergravity. So the bulk content is just one gauge boson in the bulk and then just the bulk metric. And this is sort of just theoretically interesting because it's not connected to any of the other supergravity theories that we know through dimensional reduction. And there's going to be, so Ludi and Sundram looked at this, and there's going to be a Z2 symmetry. And so, for example, they're very similar to Hrabal-Witten. So there's some charges. And they actually determine the Kähler potential when you integrate out the bulk fields and found that it was of the sequestered form. And it's actually very similar to the way we were talking about in Hrabal-Witten. Again, you have some sources on the brains that are sources for bulk gauge fields. And then when you integrate out those bulk gauge fields, you generate some contact interactions that look like the Chern-Simon squared form that we had before. Oh, Pardon?
Do you know what's going on?
No. No, they just put that in by hand. So it's some delta function, and they said that there was a current on the brain that they didn't know what the current was, but it couples to the field strength in the bulk, and then basically they determine the form of the current by requiring it to match the low energy theory. But yeah, we don't know what's going on. And yeah, it's an interesting thing is actually to require the consistency of the theory, you actually needed to generate contact interactions in the low energy theory. Okay, so that's just sort of interesting. But I should point out, they did find that it was sequestered. Okay. And now there are just some comments about this. And that is, so in that analysis, they assume the bulk was flat. Okay. But in this case, we may expect that there's some tension on the brains. And so that can warp the metric in the bulk. Okay, so there may be some warping in the bulk due to the tension on the brains. Also, generically, when you stabilize, if you put in some extra bulk physics to stabilize the modulus, you may also warp the metric. Okay, so we do expect there to be corrections to that Kaler potential. And to actually, so the issue then is, if I worry about some of these issues, of course, you may wonder whether the Kaler potential remains sequestered after including this warping. And I don't know the answer to that, but it would require some more work. But basically, what we'd have to do is repeat what Ludi and Sundrum did, where basically, so you have this warping, and that's going to change the equation of motion for the bulk gauge field. And you want to reintegrate out the bulk gauge boson in the presence of the warping and see what you get. Let's match that to the 4D theory. And I should note that, at least in the supersymmetric version of Randall syndrome, some people have already looked at this. And so in their case, you have a strong warping of what's happening in the bulk. And they seem to think it's sequestered, but I don't know if they've really calculated these sorts of terms that should be calculated. But let me just assume that it's sequestered. Okay, so I'm going to assume that when you do that, it retains the sequestered form. So there's some warping here, which I've called G. And so this is consistent with that philosophy. But now the point is that because of this warping, if there's an F, if this field gets an F component, then you do develop tree-level mass. So I'm just using this as an onset. So I'm not saying that we've computed this. And then there's just some messy expression I'm going to flash up here. But the point is that while it's horribly model dependent, the only thing I wanted to point out is that it's just interesting that in the case where the warping is pure ADS, then there is this particular function actually vanishes. So you're just sort of an interesting fact that if the warping was anti de Sitter, then there's no tree level mass for the fields on the brain, even if the radion in this case acquires an F component. Okay, so I think I'll conclude then. So there are certainly situations in which you can have scalar masses at tree level vanish. Okay, so I don't want to say that never happens. Okay, but we've found some situations in which there are tree level masses for fields living on one boundary, even if you give an F component to fields on the other boundary. And so I guess in our mind, that means that this prediction that fields on different brains don't talk to each other in the low energy theory and lead to vanishing tree level masses, that's maybe not a robust statement. And I also like to leave you that maybe the pure five-dimensional supergravity case is okay, but there might be some model-dependent contributions, as I was just referring to there. All right, so that's it. Okay. Yeah.
So just to be clear, does this mean that you're saying that the effects have been computed in the literature for anomaly mediation in the generic case where the Kaler potential isn't a sequestered form are subleading to what you just computed? There are bigger effects that we missed before?
No, so actually a lot of the results in this paper are actually in the literature, because people weren't thinking of it in the context of anomaly mediation, or they weren't thinking about having supersymmetry breaking on the hidden brain. So when people talk about at least some of the phenomenological models where some of the phenomenological models people look at is just they have this sequestered form for the Kaler potential. So then they would miss these effects, because basically, I should say, what people do is they just imagine that there's just one extra dimension. Compute it with just the one extra dimension, and then we see that everything seems fine. And so maybe there's, I guess, just an attitude that's a generic statement. Okay, Hiroshi? Okay.
So the second paragraph says volume above the volume
stuff,
but the distance is just a couple of orders smaller than that scale.
Right.
So why take the volume compression at all? Well,
if I move the brains far enough apart, so this isn't codimension one, then eventually.
In the actual situation, I thought that brain are just a part.
Oh, so you're asking, are there other leading effects? Because the dimensions are small, are there other leading effects that haven't been included here? Well, it just goes as one over the distance between the brains to some power.
Yeah, but that is much shorter than the
But I should say that the expression for the gravitational mass also goes as one over the distance between the brains. So it just goes as the volume. Oh, just in the fundamental, five-dimensional. Yeah.
And there's no so in this compression there's no rows, so a lower scale function. So it's just a compression of the front scale versus the lower.
Yeah, just the higher dimensional Planck scale. Yeah, there's
the bulk the other way. So it's like gravitational mediation. And then you get some quantum compression mediation back to 100. So you can have an intermediate scale on the other way.
Yeah, but that's subsumed into the F component of the field there.
Right.
And so I buried all that dependence into M3 halves.
So the quantum gap is also subverted by the same
factor. Yeah, so there is a factor suppressing. I should say that so these contact interactions are suppressed by the distance, but when you go and see what that translates into for the scalar masses, then that's order of the gravitational mass. Yeah, that's the main point. There aren't any additional suppressions due to the volume. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
For one extra dimension.
So it's not a TeV size.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It's just
the relevant question is what is the mass relative to gravity?
Mm-hmm.
The
black box in an F term. He never computed that. He just got the black box. But that would involve some ratio of something down Planck.
True.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the small number would come out of that. Mm-hmm. Right. So he didn't come up with that
one. That's
right.
Plus all the other masses in terms of gravity.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So the gravitational mass.
That's an
overall.
Yeah. Yeah, there's an F term in the gravitational mass. So the gravitational mass, if I work in. So the gravitational mass goes as just one over volume, depending on how many extra dimensions you have. Oh, okay, all right. So there's some. Any other questions? Okay.